Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a debt ceiling high wire act shut down in Minnesota and uproar over Casey Anthony. A debt summit at the White House, big stuff moving fast, or maybe not. Here's the president.
I want to emphasize that nothing is agreed to until everything's agreed to, and the parties are still far apart on a wide range of issues.
A jury acquits Casey Anthony in the murder of her two-year-old daughter, and the public howls.
They call this justice. They say the American flag flies today. It does not. It does anything but fly today. It's been trampled on today.
And all eyes on the last space shuttle. Jobs go with it. Shuttle worker Travis Thompson is moving on after 28 years.
My job is to put astronauts in spaceships, and America's not going to be doing that for a little while, so I need to find some work.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, Major Garrett of National Journal, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you see coming in the debt debate? Breakthrough? Crack up? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And just a note, I, Tom Ashbrook, am now tweeting. The boss lady said tweet, so I am. You can follow me on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. And to the news, Ruth Marcus is here, columnist and editorial writer for The Washington Post. Ruth, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be back.
Great to have you. Major Garrett is with us, congressional reporter for National Journal. Major Garrett, great to have you back as well.
Tom, always a pleasure. Good day.
And we've got On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ruth, and Major.
So summitry in the White House and more on the line than anybody might have really fully taken on board. Just a couple of days ago, here's President Obama at a press conference after the debt ceiling summit yesterday. Said the talks were constructive, but no deal yet.
People were frank. We discussed the various options available to us. Everybody reconfirmed the importance of completing our work and raising the debt limit ceiling so that the full faith and credit of the United States of America is not impaired.
Full faith and credit on the line. Major Garrett, what is going on in there?
It's fascinating, Tom. As you said in the open, a couple of weeks ago, there were two schools of thought. One, that this would go right up until the end, and in a panic, some sort of small deal would be reached. The debt ceiling would be increased. The markets would be somewhat calmed, but Washington would have missed an opportunity to take on all these structural drivers of debt and deficit.
Yep.
Then the idea was, well, maybe Republicans and Democrats can get to something that's a little bit larger, a little bit more ambitious than that, maybe $2 trillion of spending cuts with a little bit of tax revenue thrown in there on the margins. And that might be as much as the political bloodstream could take.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, what took hold was a concept, and it's really a theoretical concept right now, I must underscore, that being too big to fail is the way to go, meaning build in all of the things that have historically stopped Washington from acting, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, a structural revamping of the tax code, as ambitious as anything the country has seen since 1986 when the tax code was last cleaned up. And throw in other things that Washington has dealt with on a year-to-year basis but always bedevils it, like the alternative minimum tax.
Right.
Throw all those things in there, and if you throw everything in, perhaps it's too big to fail. Perhaps it's so large that you can't create a critical mass against it, and there's enough in there for enough constituent parts of all the various factions in Congress to sign on. That is the current temperament of these talks. It's the theory behind this sort of big bang theory that you've seen expressed in the newspapers this morning.
It's kind of amazing. But Ruth Marcus, I mean, and we're going to do all this, and what is it? They say like 3 or 4 days before they need to have it laid out so they can get to work, they can make legislation, get it done in time for August 2nd or July 22nd, the White House is saying all this?
Well, it's a question, I think, of that they did build in some time because there is a big question of all this. But every little jot and tittle of the details does not need to be worked out between now and August 2nd. You can have frameworks that are put in place. But I think Major made a very important point about the kind of Big Bang theory of the debt ceiling, which is, in an odd way, bigger isn't just better when it comes to reaching an agreement around the debt ceiling. It might actually be easier because there are so many different moving pieces and so many different constituencies at play that if you are reaching for a larger number and trading off more different pieces, it might just be that you can assemble the coalition of the willing, as it were, that you're going to need in order to be able to get this across the finish line. But what the president said yesterday is absolutely true. Nothing is agreed to till everything's agreed to. I suspect we will have more perils of Pauline moments before this is all done.
A little more poundage than Pauline here. I mean, a big bang, maybe, but maybe it all just blows to pieces. I mean, we heard, here's Nancy Pelosi talking after that summit, and with news that Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, all maybe on the table, all at maybe at the president's urging on the table. Here's Pelosi.
We do not support cuts in benefits for Social Security and Medicare.
Jack Beatty, what do you see coming here? It's just kind of mind-blowing how much is out there. All of a sudden, people have been talking big, but, you know, Major calls it Big Bang, and this is the whole enchilada suddenly out there in the, behind the closed doors table.
Yes, and a lot on the line politically and for the most vulnerable American citizens. According to one account, the president's willing to take 85% in spending cuts if the Republicans accept 15% in revenue increases. Included in that, steep cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. You know, the deal is problematic in two dimensions, equity and politics, and it really throws light on Mr. Obama's leadership. Wall Street recklessness and Wall Street brought politicians bear the onus for the recession. Yet if the deal goes ahead, according to one account, a widow on Social Security could be required to sacrifice $1,000 of her $12,000 in annual benefits to pay down the debt run up by the big rollers. Politically, the deal would neutralize the Democrats' best issue for regaining the House, running against the politically toxic Ryan plan to end Medicare as we know it, while lifting that incubus from the Republicans. The deal would be a Republican victory, showing that they're not the party of fanatics and capable of governing, described last week by the conservative columnist David Brooks. It might help the president, allowing him to position himself between the parties and triangulate a la Bill Clinton. At the same time, I think it shows he's a weak leader. A classic book in political science bears the title The Politics That Presidents Make. The consequential presidents, FDR, Reagan, make politics, persuade voters, sway public opinion toward their core views. President Obama hasn't made politics. He's played the politics the GOP has dealt him. Unemployment above 9%. He's accepted their argument that what's wrong with the economy is too much spending, not too little demand. He could have made the agreement to raise the debt ceiling a condition of the December deal to extend the Bush tax cut. He did not use the leverage when he had it, David Frum justly observes, and so he became a victim of leverage, the GOP threat of default, when he lacked it. He's not the victim, really. His party could be, low-income seniors could be.
That's a big tale told in that. Major Garrett, how do you interpret what President Obama is doing here? Jack says takes us back to triangulation and Bill Clinton, and of course he came back from very rocky days to win re-election on that beam. Is that the Obama strategy here? The Republicans said we want $2 trillion in cuts. He says, okay, $4 trillion. Is that the way for him to retake the White House?
Well, I would say this about triangulation. Bill Clinton achieved that in small bore measures and through one enormous policy concessions to congressional Republicans in 1996, signing welfare reform.
And school uniforms small bores, you say.
Yes. Those other smaller issues were symptomatic of a symbolism of triangulation, the symbolism of taking on culturally conservative issues and bringing them closer to Bill Clinton. If this deal, and I want to emphasize, the if cannot be written in too big of type.
Yep.
I mean, 120-point type. There's still, for every one way this could work, there are 10 ways in which it could fall apart. And Jack mentioned some of the core political reasons on the left why it could and why many on the left believe it should. But if it were to happen, this would take whatever triangulation Bill Clinton did and magnify it by about 100 times, okay? Because any Democratic president that takes on Social Security, takes on Medicare, hands those issues over to Republicans, does it in the light of day, and does it because he believes it's his path to reelection. which if he does, that's exactly why President Obama will do it, will render Bill Clinton's moderation not only something of the past, but sort of a tiny antiquated relic of American presidential politics. Because the only reason Republicans are nearing this idea of a big bang is because, as Jack said, this deal would be so lopsided in their favor. 7-8 to 1 in terms of the magnitude and the duration of spending cuts and benefit alterations as opposed to tax revenue increases or raising revenue through user fees, land sales, or auction sales of the broadband spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So the president would be going so far in the direction of Republicans, and I think for two reasons. One, the leverage of the debt ceiling, which he didn't have to grant them, but he did.
It's there right now.
It's there right now. It's a reality. Second, we have had two very bad jobs reports in two consecutive months.
Again today, unemployment up again, 9.2%, only 18,000 new jobs. People were hoping for 100,000 plus.
Exactly. Those two reports gave the Republicans a second point of leverage. The president and the White House knew that if they did not shake up the economy, they would not have a very good chance of winning re-election. This deal would be aimed at shaking up the economy in a positive direction and improving or possibly smoothing the president's path to re-election.
Boy, what a picture. Ruth Marcus, we've just got 20 seconds before the election. If he pushes forward with this, is he going to be fighting Republicans or fighting his own Democrats?
Well, I think the short answer to that question is yes, but I have so many more than 20 seconds worth of disagreement, especially with my friend Jack. And I just want to stand up for the policy argument in favor of what the administration's trying to do.
Let us come back and do that, if we may, Ruth. We've got a break right in our face here, but we'll come back and get your counter argument. We want to hear it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Looking at a week in the news, debt ceiling summitry, Casey Anthony uproar, Minnesota shut down, a Murdoch tabloid shut down. Ruth Marcus with us today from the Washington Post, Major Garrett from National Journal, and our own Jack Beatty. Ruth, I want to get your counter-framing here, but let me get a couple of callers in here, then we'll come right to you. David in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, David.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
I was a big supporter of Obama. Gave him a lot of money for what for me was a lot of money.
Yep.
Went door to door for him, but he has completely lost me now. I mean, he has become the saddest proof of the old Harry Truman adage that nobody should be allowed to run for president who can't hold their own in a serious poker game. He comes to every policy issue pre-shrinking his own position and then gives half of that away. In December, it's becoming clearer now that he should have called the Republican bluff in December, let the Bush tax cuts retire, and then come back with a bill to give tax cuts to the low and middle class. Instead, he traded it all away in December. They now know that they're working with a total pansy, and he's proving that again.
Pansy, bad poker player. Barack Obama would not like this description, but we hear it, David. Let me get one more. Jerry, thank you, David. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And as Rodney Dangerfield would say, what a crowd, huh?
what do you think? What do you think, Jerry?
Well, to be truthful, I think that the president, he shows leadership by walking behind instead of in front. And they're going to have to make some cuts. I mean, there's just no way Social Security and Medicare can survive. I mean, the numbers just don't work. I mean,
so you say bring it on. Bring on the cuts there. It's time for it, you say, Jerry.
Well, in some effects. But now the older people, it's not going to affect them if they, I mean, they can work it out. But however, what the president said just the other day is like the Republicans are holding a gun to the head of the American people. That doesn't sound very presidential. Especially after what happened in January earlier this year.
Yeah, but you're for the cuts, and we've got that. Jerry, I appreciate it. One more, and we'll come to you, Ruth. Tony in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Tony, great to have you. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Two things. I'm very disappointed in what looks to me like a sellout of Obama's core constituencies. Mm. Your callers have made all my points already. But the other thing I wanted to get your panel's opinion on is I'm assuming that the jobs report that we just got factors in government job cuts.
Absolutely. They're big. They're all over the place.
Pardon?
Yeah, absolutely it does. They're very big at this point because, you know, they're running out of money.
Exactly. But a lot of those government job cuts are being engineered by Republican elected officials certly at state and local levels.
Sure. Look
so
at
I'm
Minnesota.
Wondering if that's some strategy on the part of the Republicans to make the unemployment rate help the unemployment rate to stay high to help damage Obama's and the Democrats' chance of being reelected at the upcoming election?
It's a good question. Of course, they would not put it that way. They would say we're here to save the economy long term. But Ruth Marcus, you hear the listeners' responses here. Let's get your counter framing. I mean, the New York Times today, you know, they're saying the president's accepted this false and dangerous premise that the nation's budget problems are entirely a matter of overspending on the needy and not of undertaxing the rich. They want him to go the other way. What do you say, Ruth?
Well, briefly, they're wrong. I don't think that that's the president's premise. It's a little odd for me to be in this position because over the last months, I've expressed a lot of frustration in print with the president's approach to being serious about the deficit, with his failure to lead on putting the country on a sustainable fiscal course. But I find it a little bit odd to be bemoaning a deal whose contours aren't set yet and whose mm-hmm. details we haven't seen yet. I'd remind everybody that of the incredible shrinking cuts that we saw in the agreement on the continuing resolution, where it looked like there was a huge number of cuts, and when the final numbers came out from the Congressional Budget Office, the cuts were way less than what Speaker John Boehner had told his caucus they were. So let's take a look at who is being cut, what is being cut, what the actual figures are.
Well, we don't really know, but they're saying $4 trillion. That's not a small number.
Well,
$2 trillion was the GOP.
$4 trillion
target.
Is not a small number, but you and I could get to a very sensible, if not painless, $4 trillion that would be balanced. And, you know, as much as Nancy Pelosi is upset and complaining about the potential for harmful cuts in Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits, Republicans have been saying for months, if not years now, that we cannot raise net a single dime of tax revenue, which is an even more unsustainable, infuriating position. And to the extent that they are willing finally to accept as part of a deal that we need new tax revenue, that would be a major achievement on the president's part. So I am much, much more optimistic and hopeful about this deal than Jack and maybe Major and certainly the callers that we've heard from so far seem to be.
Major, I want to get you on that, but Jack, maybe this is, high-stakes poker learned in that Illinois legislature games after dark in Springfield. Maybe the president's, you know, crazy like a fox here.
Well, you certainly can't call him timid. I mean, to make this kind of big, bold, last-minute offer. Our callers have been raising this question. Has he played the best hand he could? I mean, has he played a hand that's consistent with the people that put him there? The people that put him there, overwhelming vote from people earning less than $30,000 a year. Those are the people he's got to protect, it seems to me, as a moral proposition. And so you would hope that he would go into any such deal like that with a bottom line that would say, no, you know, this is going to be, if we got to get revenue on Medicare, let it come from having the government push down drug prices, negotiate down drug prices, which would, of course, lower the cost of medical care overall, would be good just generally. If we have to do something on Social Security, let's go up on the cap, the tax cap, so that higher earners pay more for Social Security. I mean, there are things you could do there that would save lots of money, but that would be true to the people that put him there.
And what will happen in this kind of rush toward August 2nd? Major, I'm coming right to you, but first, Kelly in Nashville. You're on the air, Kelly.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was wondering, so the Republicans during the last election were essentially running on jobs, and they said very little about the deficit. And we have 44 million Americans who are in poverty right now, and no one talks about what it costs to have a living wage. Someone who makes $7.25 an hour, which is the minimum wage, and works 40 hours a week and is a single mother and has to pay rent and electricity and heat and transportation and health care and all kinds of stuff. How are they supposed to make it?
And that's the core constituency Jack's talking about it, and you're saying amen, I guess. Kelly, thanks for your call. Major Garrett, how do you see the poker playing out here? I mean, you were writing a couple of days ago, you know, talking, you interviewed Captain America, and he said, no way, no how, we're going to have a deal here. Has the president blown it up to another scale where it may happen? And what may it look like? How, give us the sort of engineer's, political engineer's view of what's going on here.
Well, when the president brought the members, the leadership members to the White House yesterday, he gave them three proposals. And they all said, let's try to go for the biggest one. That's a try. That's an attempt. And we're going to find out by Sunday, and I would say if not Sunday, certainly by no later than Wednesday of next week, whether the Big Bang Theory is anything more than a theory. And what you have in Washington, and you've had for the better part of 12 to 18 months, is a lot of very smart people who used to wear partisan uniforms who've sort of gotten out of that. Erskine Bowles, former Bill Clinton chief of staff, Alan Simpson, Alice Rivlin, Pete Domenici, coming together and saying, look, these issues can no longer be addressed the way that Washington has addressed them before. And if you put everything in the mix, then you might get a political consensus. And with everything on the table and everything in the mix, we can address these problems, lower deficits, and lower the debt burden for not just 2 or 3 years, but possibly 15 or 20 years. And you're getting in Washington right mm-hmm. now a sense of generational commitment to doing something big. That's at the leadership level.
Yeah.
But I must stress, until the details first are hammered out, then reviewed by rank-and-file members in both parties, and let me just offer one bit of caution about the Senate. Because there's no Senate budget resolution this year, whatever happens cannot be protected by a 50-vote or 51-vote majority. It has to get 60, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So anything that is propounded by President Obama, Speaker Boehner, House Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has to get 60 votes in the Senate. That's an incredibly high threshold for some very tough issues, and that is one and only one of many potential obstacles, but among the biggest.
How great the chance that we still slam into August 2nd without a deal and with all the consequences that at least we've been warned about. I hear Republicans say, oh, no, it'll be fine, but we've been warned it could be drastic. Warren Buffett saying this week, you know, get going here. Everything's on the line.
If they try and reach big and they fail, then I think the president believes he can't be blamed for not giving it a go. And in that exhaustion and in that sense of depressed mania about reaching so high but falling short, it'll be easier to get a consensus on a smaller package. That's another theory. We are operating in ways I haven't seen since I came to Washington in 1990, theoretical politics playing out on a very high-stakes stage.
Boy, these are some times. A couple of calls, and we'll go to Minnesota. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
The point that I think nobody has brought up in this whole process is that Social Security doesn't require that we appropriate money for it. That's already been paid for. People have paid, and there are more than $2 trillion in surplus that is waiting to be paid out. So I think it's very disingenuous, and frankly, I can't understand why the president wouldn't make this a huge point. They are stealing the money.
But you know, how it gets paid out is a big deal, and there's talk about a cliff out there somewhere. Are you afraid that in these negotiations it's going to be swept away anyway, Jim?
Well, that's, of course, what is being talked about, and that, in no uncertain terms, is saying we're going to honor the bonds paid for, that people that have a lot of money to invest in bonds think of as the safest investment in the world, and we're going to default on the bonds that people like myself have paid for with their money. 15% of my money has gone to that.
Jim, we got it. That's not the last we'll hear of that, if that's where this goes. One more, Jan in Concord, Massachusetts. Jan, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I am thrilled the president has thrown this idea out on the table, and I am your garden variety lunch bucket liberal who grew up waiting on tables and eventually went to work for the liberal of them all, Tip O'Neill.
Okay.
And I think that this guy has said enough, or I think he's crazy like a fox, and he's challenging my generation, the 50-year-olds, the 60-year-olds, to say, if you want to leave a legacy, here's how you're going to give it to your kids. And if you want to be the greatest generation like our parents were, start dealing with this problem. He's putting everything, including Medicare, including Social Security, that frankly, a lot of his affluent supporters do not need. And he's putting it on the table and saying, let's go after this and figure out a way to do it so that the pie gets distributed, perhaps, some would argue, inappropriately, but to the people that need it.
Jan, we got it. From Tip O'Neill's side to a new view in the year 2011, and the president, you know, smelling the political winds very, very carefully. No question here was stakes as high as they can be. I want to turn to the Minnesota shutdown. And Jack, I mean, you're watching what's going on out there. You've got the Democratic governor, Republican legislature, and everything on ice right now. They can't get a budget together, and most of the state's operations shut down. Is that the national future? Are we going to see that in more states, Jack?
Well, it's a portent, that's for sure. And all of this seems to be about the fate of 7,700 millionaires, or people who earn over $1 million a year in Minnesota. The governor, the Democratic governor, wanted them to pay more in taxes. It would, in fact, be a pretty high increase in taxes, making Minnesota one of the highest taxed states in the country for wealthy earners. And he wanted cigarette buyers to pay a dollar more a pack. And the Republicans said no over those 7,700. And in return, and what's happening in return? Well, look, as the portent department, bond rating down on Minnesota. It's been bad for a while, but it's getting worse. Tax revenues, government revenues are paralyzed. Nothing's happening. Government services are going down. It's costing more than it would have to keep the government in operation. It's a portent, and I think that the New York Times this week praised the governor for standing up to the Republicans. It may be that the president doesn't have that option. I mean, I've been critical of him, but you have to face reality. Minnesota isn't the United States government. A default of the government here would be such a catastrophe for everybody in the country that that the president may not have the option of that Governor Dayton has of standing firm.
I want to turn to the Republican challengers coming up in 2012. Mitt Romney, of course, when he announced for the presidency, saying the president's failed. He didn't cause the recession, but he made it worse. He said it again, bad tape here, but on the 4th of July in Amherst, New Hampshire.
And the president's failed. He did not cause this recession, but he made it worse.
Fact checkers quibbled with that, but then Romney quibbled with it himself. Here he is in Allentown, Pennsylvania on Thursday afternoon.
I didn't say that things are worse. What I said was that the economy hasn't turned around.
Oh boy, he did say things were worse. Ruth Marcus, what's going on with Mitt Romney here? Supposed to be the front runner, but this is like an old Romney move.
And it's supposed to be the front runner and also supposed to be smart enough to remember what he said 2 minutes ago. And I actually have always found this to be an odd and unnecessary argument on Governor Romney's part, because it is inaccurate to say that the president made everything worse. It seems to me it's a perfectly fine Republican argument to say things are not as good as they should be, and why do you want to reelect the guy who says things might have been worse if I hadn't acted, and to sort of come forward with a positive Republican plan. Instead, he's been making and then denying that he made an argument that I don't think is sustainable, that the stimulus spending, that the auto bailout, that the continuation of TARP, that the other things the president did made the economy worse than they would have been otherwise. I think that almost every serious economic analysis of those programs has shown that things would be way worse without that action. That's not a particularly terrific program for the president to run on for re-election, but it also shows the error of Romney's sometimes argument.
Major Garrett, who breaks to the front here? We got 10 seconds. Romney, Bachman, somebody else?
Romney stays the leader until the votes are counted in Iowa and New Hampshire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a cheating scandal erupts in the Atlanta public school system. Teachers changing students' answers on standardized tests wholesale. Here's Interim Superintendent Errol Davis.
We have cheated students. This angers us all. It is hard for us to quantify and often express that anger.
Phoenix, covered in dust, an epic dust storm. Dust cloud, a wall of dust a mile high and up to 100 miles wide. Biblical. One Arizona resident said it was unlike anything she's seen.
We saw just this cloud of dust. I mean, biggest thing I've ever seen, and I've lived here all of my life.
And Rupert Murdoch's British tabloid, The News of the World, taken down in a phone hacking scandal. Prime Minister David Cameron said the idea that they may have hacked the phones even of victims in the 2005 London subway terrorist bombings was despicable.
We're talking about murder victims, potentially terrorist victims, having their phones hacked into. It is absolutely disgusting at what has taken place, and I think everyone in this House, and indeed this country, will be revolted by what they've heard and what they've seen on their television screens.
You can join us this hour. What are you thinking about Murdoch's tabloid troubles, the Roger Clemens perjury trial, the shuttle's last flight? And are you fired up on the Casey Anthony case? Is it a vindication of the jury system or an indictment of it? With Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, Major Garrett of National Journal, our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to John in Amherst, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I'm curious about the Rupert Murdoch scandal and concurrent with the News of the World headlines this week was a story about how Roger Ailes, as far back as the Nixon era, had plotted to set up Fox as a GOP mouthpiece on the political scene. I'm wondering if there's going to be any blowback on this side of the Atlantic with regard to how Fox affects American politics.
We will look at it. Of course, big scandal, huge in the UK this week with the news that reporters had been hacking into cell phones and texts, being paid, paying police for information and police taking those payments to get numbers and inside access, using all that in the paper. Now, Murdoch closing that paper down, whether that's what exactly that means, we'll look at. Here's his son and likely sort of heir in power in the News Corporation, James Murdoch, announcing the end of the News of the World yesterday. And he told Britain's independent television news that he regrets the phone hacking scandal that took down the tabloid.
I feel regret. Clearly, the practices of certain individuals did not live up to the standards and quality of journalism that we believe in and that I believe in, and that this company believes in. This company has been a great investor in journalism, a greater investor in media in general, and it's something that we believe very strongly in.
Earthquake scale scandal in the UK. Major Garrett, I don't know if you've been looking across the pond there, but you know this empire. We all do. News Corporation, huge holdings in media all over the place, including, as our caller says, Fox News with Roger Ailes. You worked at Fox for years, Major. What do you see going on here? Is Rupert Murdoch in enough trouble that he's running for cover and closing this down? Is it somehow a savvy business move? What's happening?
Well, I don't think there's any question that he is in big trouble, that News Corp is in trouble in the UK. This is happening about the same time that News Corp is trying to acquire all the rest of Sky News in Britain. Mm-hmm. It was nearing the end of the regulatory approval of that process. My gut tells me that regulatory approval process may be short-circuited entirely. It will certainly be delayed. So this scandal from a News Corp acquisitions point of view could not have been worse timed. And when I hear Rupert Murdoch's son talk about journalism, well, he can't say – I mean, News of the World is a tabloid, a saucy – among the sauciest, and that's saying quite a bit in the UK, UK tabloids, mm-hmm. published mm-hmm. only on Sundays.
Right.
And they try to hold politicians, celebrities, soccer stars accountable, very aggressive. It had sort of a populist mentality, if you will, and the rich and famous loved it because they liked all the prurient details. And technology created a temptation that they simply could not resist. They should have resisted it. Any journalistic ethic would have told them to resist it, but they didn't. And what management knew and how it consorted and compelled reporters to go down this road, we'll find out soon enough. Shutting down the paper puts one Band-Aid over a series of gaping wounds. There will be criminal investigations. There'll be civil lawsuits. There will be financial implications for those who work there and for News Corp, but it had to do something to express corporate revulsion over something that we don't know yet how much the corporation actually knew and tolerated. That part of the story yet to be told.
Ruth, I don't know if you're following this, but do you see, our caller asks, is there a wider vulnerability here now in News Corp? You certainly don't feel it in this country as far as I can see, but what about it, Ruth?
I thought it was a kind of apples and oranges question. This behavior is repulsive and unethical. And I'm sorry if I'm reading too much into his tone. He didn't sound terribly regretful. And
James Murdoch.
And the notion of closing the newspaper, okay, I understand it's a feint in the direction of responsibility, but the fact of the matter, as I understand it, is that they have other newspapers in that space that don't now publish on Sundays that could move into the Sunday space and take over the sauciness, in Major's nice words. At the same time, it seems to me that it's a completely different situation of the absolutely irresponsible, immoral behavior of the News of the World in London and the just clear, partisan, you can call it fair and balanced, journalism of Fox News here. One is open and above board, and you get what you see, and you understand what they're doing. And the other, I'm talking about Fox News here, and people can choose to listen and believe or not listen and criticize. But that's awfully different from absolutely unethical behavior on the other side of the pond.
Jack, what do you say? I mean, maybe there's a thread of connection here. Rupert Murdoch has always worked the edges and worked them hard. It's had a big impact all over the planet, including here in the United States. I mean, the sort of, you know, the political lean, the hard politicization of news that we've seen in the last decade. He surely had a large hand in that, Jack. Do you see vulnerability there or just a little dust up in the UK?
I think the latter. I don't say, I agree with Ruth. I think that's a good distinction. What was done in Britain was underhanded. What's done here is above board. However, this doesn't get around what he has done with his journalistic enterprises here. Just this week, the maid in the Dominique Strikes Khan case has sued his New York Post for libel for calling or intimating that she was a...
They called her a prostitute and a hooker. They said she turned tricks while she was in the hotel under government custody.
Right, right. I mean, you know, that's...
And they're being sued.
Yeah, they're being sued, and it sounds like properly. We don't know the merits of that, but that's the example of just what you were saying, taking things right to the edge here. And that's been his MO. I'm grateful that the country is big enough that what Simon Hoggart has been saying in the Guardian about British politicians now out from under, suddenly this, I think Tony Blair spoke of the media there as a feral beast. Suddenly the biggest of those beasts is quieted and politicians are saying, oh, we don't have to be afraid. The tyrant is dead. Mm. Well, thank heaven we're not in that position here. Murdoch is powerful, and especially in Republican politics, but the country is just too big and too diverse for one man to have that kind of stamp on an entire political establishment.
But it's a lesson here, too, to watch out for how technology is used. I want to get to, we have to get to Casey Anthony, but let me get another call here for Savannah, Georgia. Diana, you're on the air, Diana.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a teacher, mm-hmm. and I'm really disappointed in the Obama's education policy. I'm not a Bush fan. I never was a Bush fan, and Race to the Top has really hurt the teaching profession and the learning of the children. However, at least it had the word child in it, and now we have Race to the Top. It's all about teacher accountability, and as a teacher, I have 20-something children in my room for 45 minutes a day, and then my family's livelihood and my family's, you know, as a single mother, my ability to raise my children is based on those test scores.
So are you thinking about the Atlanta scandal, Diana, and all the teachers who were changing, sitting down with erasers and changing their kids' test answers so they would look better on the standardized scores, no small number of them saying so that they wouldn't lose their income?
Yes, and it's just going to get worse under Race to the Top. That's what it's all about. Right now, Georgia is a Race to the Top state, and we have the principals are learning how to evaluate. It's going to take a huge amount of their time to look at teachers. I agree that great teachers make great students, but how many of us, if you think about it, in your lifetime, mm-hmm. how many teachers did you have?
Well,
and how many of them were great? And still you turned out to be you know, a national figure. You're wonderful, Tom.
Yeah, well, listen, but God loved all those teachers, and I don't think they were changing my test scores, and I don't see how we can get along in a country where that's the way things may have been working. Though I hear you, Diana, with your family's livelihood on the line, that is a lot of pressure. If I may, let me just table this. We're going to talk about the Atlanta scandal on Monday, and I want to just hold it right there for the moment. Diana, tune in on Monday. We're going to go deep on that front. Let me get one more right here. Dothan, Alabama. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was going to comment on the Casey Anthony problems down there. It seems like folks have turned into a lynch mob down there, their mentality, when we have the rule of law. And that's terrible.
You think that the jury did its job then, or are you sympathetic with the anger outside the courtroom?
Oh, no, sir. I believe in rule of law. I think the jury did its job. There's no such thing as perfect, but we have to go along with what the law says, and we don't need to turn into lynch mobs.
Yeah, and people worried about their lives down there, her life, the judge's life. Of course, there was a very little girl who died in this whole situation as well. We've got tape from the emotional post-verdict interview with ABC News. This is Barbara Walters asking Casey Attorney's attorney, Jose Baez, how he felt.
I felt a great sense of relief. I felt I was ecstatic for my client. Really, the happiest moment came after the first not guilty, because I knew I had saved her life. And that was really my biggest fear. And I once I got through that, I grabbed Casey's hand and I held it.
But boy, is there a lot of anger out there about the fact that the daughter died and she walks. George Stephanopoulos talked to juror number 3 on that jury, Jennifer Ford, after the trial. He asked her what evidence she would have needed to convict.
I'm not sure what I needed exactly. They had strong circumstantial evidence. They just needed something solid to just say it was not an accident. Just kind of tie it all together and not leave the dots for us to kind of, or me to kind of connect with speculation and accusations and guessing. Like, we're instructed not to do that.
Case not made, says the juror, but there's a lot of cable-fueled uproar out there, and it is hard to understand what happened here. Marshall in Columbia, South Carolina. Marshall, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to echo the previous callers. I think that I'm proud of the American justice system and the people down there. It took a great deal of courage. I watched, and I was afraid that she would be convicted without proof, and I believe that that family knows what occurred. I don't know truly what occurred, but thank God that they did not convict her without proof. I mean, that would be horrible for all of us, and I think justice will be provided because her life will never be the same. I hope, however, that vigilante justice doesn't come into play and that she and the jurors are protected.
Yeah, we will see. That has yet to play out as she leaves prison. Major Garrett, you hear the tenor of the calls we're getting right here, but you surely have also seen the straight-up protests in the streets and heard the concern over the very life of Casey Anthony and others involved in this case now. What do you make of this, Major?
Well, one observation, Tom, is the distorting aspect that cable news brings to some high-profile legal cases, turning them into never-ending soap operas, largely for ratings. And the audience gets drawn in because this case was fascinating. It had many components of Casey Anthony's behavior that were repellent or certainly odd after the missing report of her child and the delayed missing report of her child, Kaylee.
Partying away on the other side of that, yeah.
And the tattoo and everything. But cable is there theoretically to explain, not to incite and not to provoke. And I think in this case, it did both. It incited and provoked a visceral public reaction as opposed to taking the jury system, which is supposed to operate on one premise and one premise alone, reasonable doubt. Every American citizen walks into a courtroom 100% innocent. It is the prosecution's obligation to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. 12 jurors sat there, listened to everything, could not, and in very short order decided, could not, unanimously overcome that hurdle. Therefore, she is found not guilty, not innocent, not guilty. And therefore, the justice system, in my estimation, has prevailed. And I must tell you, Tom, I was astonished watching my Twitter feed that afternoon, people saying, where's the justice? I'm like, it's right there in front of you. Understand the system. The system rendered a verdict. That is justice.
Ruth Marcus, what do you make of the outcome and the public response to it?
I say amen to everything that Major just said and to the tenor of the calls. I think that the temptation would have to be, if you were a juror in this case, to look at a problematic defendant and an adorable little girl, a terrible tragedy, and it would be easy to sort of say, well, something terrible happened and we need to convict somebody. I think from what I've read of the interviews with the jurors, the system worked exactly as it's supposed to. Sometimes guilty people go free. Sometimes there's just not enough proof. The one question that I do have is whether we have gotten to a point of a sort of extreme CSI mentality where jurors have been conditioned that if you don't have the absolutely perfect DNA technological proof, that they're not willing to convict. But as a general matter, I leave the case feeling very sad about what happened, but very good about the system.
Jack, what do you say to the public, the listener out there who says, but it, you know, you watch this and it looks like a society where anything goes. There's the mother dancing, the daughter's dead, we see it all, and courts don't stop it.
Well, there's always that, isn't there? The gap between moral responsibility and what we call, just speaking freely, responsibility, and the limits of the law. And I think that Major gave a civics lesson in his description of that.
We got it there this week. We'll see how all that unfolds. High emotion. Maybe everybody needs to settle down a little bit here, but I don't know where that comes in. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Major Garrett, it's always great to have you from National Journal. Thanks for joining us today, Major.
Thanks very much for having me.
Ruth Marcus, terrific to have you as well. Thanks for joining us from the Washington Post.
Thanks a lot.
And Jack, thank you as always.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, have a good weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.